this is my mind. So going through this study this weekend, a couple, you know, I've kind of looked forward. I knew this is the week I was going to be teaching. And I was like, oh, there's a lot of sin. There's a lot of death. How do we deal with this? And then I started thinking, you know what? There's a broader picture here. And what's made the most sense of it is to think of these chapters in light of God's covenant. And so I have this book. It's actually been on my shelf for many years. I don't know how long it's been on my shelf. But it's a book that Dave of church gave to my dad on his birthday in 2000. And it's called Christ of the Covenants. Has anybody read this book? Okay. A couple. I did tell Dave I read it this week, and he was like, he said it was a little dry. Which it's not this is not pleasure reading, but if you have a purpose and you want to find out about the covenants, this is a great, great book. And last night when I was just finishing up my study, I was noticing my toenail polish matches the cover of the book. So I was like, it was definitely meant to be that I would be doing this. Anyway, my big point is, if we get an understanding of this overarching theme of the covenant, I think we'll see where these chapters fall in better. And my goal is to just help us see where that fits in. I may not get to everything in these chapters. I've prepared it, but I may not get there. And so I will send you along to discuss in your groups the wonderful treasures you find there. But okay, so let's just get started. Let's jump in to these covenants. Some of you may be very familiar with these covenants. Others may not. I would say, growing up, we went to a house church, and so I have very little tradition in my background. A lot of Bible, really good teaching. My dad loved Martin Lloyd-Jones, and he loved just teaching straight through the Bible. My dad was one of the teachers at our church. I learned a lot from him, but I will say I did not learn much about the covenants. I didn't know much about the covenants until I started going to Grace. And that may be, how many of you prior to coming to Grace were familiar with the idea of covenants? So prior to, okay, a handful. How many of you were introduced to covenants at Grace? Okay, so that's kind of a mix. Now guess what? Grace is not the originator of covenants. It's been in the Bible for the whole time the Bible's been here. This is something that blew me away when I first started studying covenants in women's Bible study, probably when I was in college or I don't know. But I went home to my dad and I was like, Dad, did you know the Old Testament and the New Testament, that's just another name for the Old Covenant and the New Covenant? And he was like, yeah. I was like, well, why didn't you ever tell me that before? That makes a lot more sense. So did you know when they translated the Bible from Latin to English, they obviously were using Latin. And the Latin word for covenant is like, testimonium. Everything has an am. Testimonium. Don't quote me on that. But so they translated every word in the Bible testament for covenant originally. But then when they revised it, when they started translating from Hebrew and Greek, they changed all the mentions of testament to covenant, except for one. In Hebrews, it really is talking about the last will and testament, and they left that one as testament. All the other ones were changed to covenant. But why didn't they change the title of the book? Like, Old Testament, New Testament, they changed all the other words, but they didn't change Old Covenant. Wouldn't that help you? I think that would help me to know, oh, this is about the covenants, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. Anyway, that's just a little tidbit, and I digress and probably will send you to your small groups needing to talk a lot about these things. Okay, so now, let me just, there was one thing I didn't finish here. We are going to block off this section of the covenants. We can separate all the covenants into two sections. This first covenant that is made with Adam in the garden, in his innocence, I didn't get all of my things written, but in his innocence, is anybody familiar with what this covenant is called? You're not gonna like it, but nobody knows? Okay, huh? Covenant of works, and we hear that word and we're just like, oh, I cannot believe that. But it was in the garden. This is different than what we're under. This is only garden covenant. It's the covenant of works. Adam, the covenant with Adam was, you must obey this command, do not eat from the tree, and you will live, you'll have everlasting life. But what happened? Adam failed. Sin entered the world. And you'll find that, well, I'll explain this later, but you'll find that the need for a covenant always follows some sort of moral decline or failure. So Adam sins. We have a need for God to step in and institute a covenant. The covenant that he makes with Adam in Genesis 3:15, he actually is speaking to Eve, but just man in general, is the covenant of commencement. It also has another long name, Protevangelium. And this is basically the first announcement of the gospel in the Bible. In 3:15, God says, I'm going to put enmity between Satan and the woman. They were friendly in the garden. I'm going to put enmity between them. And the seed from the woman and a seed from Satan are always going to be enemies. They're always going to be at war. And we see that playing out throughout Genesis so far. But we also see the prophecy that one day a seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the serpent, and the serpent is going to crush the heel of the seed. Now, this is another little off, but it's kind of funny. Funny and sad at the same time. So my mom was in an accident January 1st, and she had all sorts of broken bones. One of her broken bones was her right heel was crushed, and it was excruciating pain. And in the hospital, she just kept saying, "Oh, I am just like Satan. My heel is crushed." And I said, "Mom, no. Jesus's heel gets crushed. Satan's head was crushed. You're not Satan because you're still here." So, but she was just going on and on. I'm just like Satan. No, he's the one that just, I don't know. But anyway, she was just a, that, so the proto-evangelium is forever, she gets it. She gets the crushing of the heel and the crushing of the head. So, this is our first covenant. So, this is a promise. They have this hope. You know that they have this hope. But things really go very bad, and you get to the point where in Genesis 6, I believe, 6, it's where God says all the intentions of their hearts were only evil continually. The world is a violent, violent place. So violent that God just decides to wipe it clean and start over. So something about the covenants, something about all of these covenants, they all build on each other. They are progressive. In the Christ of the Covenants, he uses the reference to going from infancy to maturity. So hence my stick figures going from young to bigger. This is why I always use Lindsay to do my drawings. But anyway, so this is supposed to show you they build on each other. They aren't separate entities. They all function together. Okay, so this covenant that God makes to Noah after he comes off the ark is called the Covenant of Preservation. You can find it in Genesis 9:2-6. This covenant basically is going to limit the violence on the earth. He puts the fear of man into all the animals, so they aren't going to be out of control. And he gives, in here he also gives this stipulation that if you kill someone, you are going to be killed. So it's going to limit the violence that's going on at this point. And that's where you see these covenants come in. It's an initiation of a relationship. God's coming in and initiating and making, just kind of unveiling or revealing himself to his people at the right time, at the right moment. So if this is infancy, Noah's time would be maybe the terrible twos, where you just can't quite get control of them. So we have this preservation lasts for a while, but then we have what happens after they come off the ark. What's going to be this downfall? Babel. Did I hear Babel? So Babel, yes, they all join together. Babel. So we see Babel coming in. God confuses their language, sends them out, but then he calls this one in the next chapter after Babel. Babel's chapter 11. In chapter 12, Abraham is living in the city of Ur, and modern scholars think Ur is very near the site of the original Babel. So he's calling Abraham out of this place. And he, again, gives this covenant to move his people. The point of the covenants has always been to redeem a people for himself, to rescue a people out of their sin and death. And what does this chapter, these chapters that we read this week, they need some rescuing. They need some major rescuing. So we have this covenant of promise given to Abraham. We'll call Abraham stage toddler stage. You know, there can be those sweet moments of childlike faith that Abraham shows, but oh my, those toddlers can get a little unruly. And we see them getting very unruly in these chapters. I have some toddlers that can get a little unruly. So we have this covenant of promise. So we're getting, so these three chapters, this is why I am doing all this work to, one more thing. So this is the covenant of works. These all the way to the new covenant can be titled under the covenant of grace. All right, so that's a big key, covenant of grace. I'm just going to put grace right here, grace. And this was the covenant of works. I'm not even going to write that because somebody might just see it and think, except like we just hear that word and we just cringe. We think that that's wrong, or it was back here. Back here, this is the only place it happened. So these three chapters, I think, really help us to see the need for a new stage of the covenants. Because the covenant of promise worked with Abraham, Isaac, sort of is working with Jacob, but you're going to see a shift in these chapters, and especially next week, it's going to move away from God speaking to this line, this seed that's going through. Because who's the next one in line? We've got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Who is it? We'll find out. We'll find out as I'm talking later. But so, yeah, if you don't know, I'll tell you later. Okay. So what this does is it really causes God, okay, you know what, you guys? It's time to go to school. It's school time. We're getting out of these toddler years. We need some structure. We need clear understanding of what God wants. All right, he's been getting some individual instructions to people through the covenant of promise, some nice relationship, but it's not a full picture. It's not a very full picture. And the law is not a full picture, but it's much more full than what they had at the stage of the covenant of promise. So the covenant of law, so now we have, what happens here, you're going to see is this family of Israel is going to get moved into Egypt. And they are going to be set there for 400 years. It's kind of like a timeout for 400 years. We need to, they really in these chapters threatened the covenant. And we will see there were some major threats to the covenant. So God's saying, no, you can't. He told Abraham that this was going to happen. He told them that this was going to happen, kind of like, I'm warning you, this will happen. So they get moved into slavery for 400 years. When they are brought out, Moses is the one that communicates with God. But it's for the nation of Israel. So no longer can you have this one-on-one communication of God's will. You now need a law. In the law, the way he referred to it, so the person that wrote this book is O. Palmer Robertson. So the way O. Palmer refers to this is he said, and it must be an Old Testament way of saying it, it's the 10 words or the 10 commandments. And we know that the rest of the law just kind of fleshes out those 10 words that are given. They are an external revealing of God's will. And that, and it provides so many things that will help them better know how to be ready for Christ. The number one thing that the law does is it shows them their sin. And it reveals their sin. The other thing the law does is it's like a teacher or a tutor that leads them to Christ. So Galatians, I believe, uses that term. But so we need this law to get them ready, to teach them, because we need to get those unruly toddlers more ready. We need to get them ready for the next stage. So we have this law that's given. The next drop-off, can you guys identify the next drop-off? What happens after? So we have the 400 years of slavery, and they come out. Then we have, and then there's judges, all right? And the judges are a very, very bad time, again. So we see that the law, so one thing about these covenants, they build on each other, but they also show they are not equipped to save these people. We need more. We always need a little bit more. And the law was not the answer. It was never supposed to save. It was always supposed to point them to Christ. So judges were another downfall where there was no king in Israel. They did what was right in their own eyes. And so then God initiates this covenant of the kingdom with David, where he says, I'm going to put a king on your throne forever. Forever. And so we feel like, oh, that could be this could be it. This could be really good. But then we see those kings fail. And then what's our drop off right before here? What happens at the end of the kings? Exile, which feels like we are completely lost. We've lost our nation. We've lost everything. We're spread out. We're in slavery to these people, basically. And they are brought back, but it feels not quite the same. But then Christ comes, and this covenant is new, but it's a continuation of all of those covenants in the Old Testament or Old Covenant. So this one's called sorry I had to turn sideways because I knew I was going to run out of space. Covenant of consummation, that just means covenant of fulfillment. This covenant that Christ brings fulfills all the other covenants. All right, so everything that went on, and this is a very brief overview, but I want to kind of give you guys the sense that it all fits together, okay? All right, now, okay, Lindsay, you tell me. Okay, perfect. Okay, so we've got 10 minutes now to jump in. So do you guys see where these chapters fit? We're kind of getting into this transition for these people to be moved into slavery, to be sent into that long time out after toddlerhood. I need pictures too. I'm a visual, if you guys haven't noticed, I'm a visual person. And these types of things will stick with me for the rest of my life. So this is, for me, reading, this is where I got stuck reading. All I wanted to find out about was this covenant with Abraham, but my mind kept going, well, I just don't get the covenant of the law. Like, it just doesn't make sense to me, like, how that's an improvement on this covenant of promise. Does anyone else's mind go there at all? Sort of. I'm losing some people. Oh, no. Okay, so this covenant of promise feels just, that's it. Faith. Abraham was justified by his faith, and why can't that just work? Why can't we just take that preschooler and just say, let's just jump you right up to maturity? But if they aren't ready, he is showing his children and grandchildren and great children, great grandchildren are showing this is not enough. This builds. This continues all the way through. This faith continues all the way through. And the covenant of law cannot be understood without that faith. But we need it. We need this law to move us and train us and get us, even just make us need Christ. They needed to know their need. And we need to know our need. So if we don't know the law well, we maybe don't know our need. We maybe don't know our sin very well. Okay, so quickly, let's see here. So we're gonna quickly run through these chapters. So we left off last time in chapter 33, where Abraham has erected this altar and called it El Elohi Israel. And you think, oh, well, he gets it. He really understands that God is his God. And that is a really great step for him. He had moved from a place of not understanding that to this place where he seems to understand it. But what you need to look at is, where is he right now? And what is he doing? Because he's not necessarily acting like God is the God of Israel. Because he, if you look in verse 17, it says, Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house. Has anyone else built a house? I can't. Abraham didn't build a house. Isaac, he may have in the time that Jacob's been gone, but he has not built a house. Jacob just built a house, and he's in Succoth. Does anybody remember where he's supposed to be going? Bethel. God says, return to Bethel. And Succoth is not Bethel. He builds a house, builds booths for his livestock. Then he comes to the city of Shechem, and he sets up his tent just outside the city of Shechem. It says he could see the city, within sight of the city. And then he goes and he buys land. He buys land here. Now, Shechem is not far from Bethel. It's about 30 miles away. It's one day's journey from where he's supposed to go. One day's journey. And I read commentators who said this section, he could have spent as much as 10 years here. So it's a day's journey, and he is lingering for a long, long time at the gates of this city, reminiscent of Lot moving his tent to the city when that's not the place he needed to be. And you see the ramifications of this choice playing out in chapter 34 as his daughter goes in, she gets raped, Shechem, did they name the city after Shechem, or did he name, yeah, who's the city is named after. He's the man, so he's a prominent person in the city, asks to marry her, but they come and they say, come, let's give your daughters to us, we'll give your daughters to you guys, and we'll join together. We'll give you land, and you can dwell here. It's like they're offering all of the things that the covenant is offering, but is this the way God wants it to happen? No, this is a major threat to the covenant. Jacob should have seen that and right away said, we need to get out of here. But what does he do? He's silent. He's very silent in this chapter until he gets threatened. So then we have the sons who get more riled up about it. They come in and do another very awful. So the sign of the covenant of promise is circumcision, the sign of the covenant that lasted all the way until Jesus came was circumcision. And his sons use circumcision to enable them to destroy all the men of the city. That is very awful, to say the least. That is not God. That, if you want to stir God's anger, that is a good way to do it. If you want to stir the father's, if the toddler wants to stir the father's anger, that's a very good way to get him upset. Okay, so we see this happening. Now Jacob speaks. He says, okay, all these people that I've tried to make friends with, now they're all going to be after me. They're going to attack me. So now God steps in, rescues him out, because he is the one. He is the one God has chosen to fulfill, like to put his blessing on, to give these promises to and through his family. And so God has to take him out. And so in chapter 35, we see God tell Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel, dwell there, make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. So again, what do we see at this point? We see kind of possibly one of the reasons why Jacob lingered and wasn't ready to go to Bethel, his house is full of idols, idol worship, idols, earrings, their clothing, it sounds like, was even clothing that defiled them. And so he told them to put away your gods, purify yourselves, change your clothes, and let us arise and go to Bethel. So this is really that idea of the putting off those old ways. And this whole chapter is a lot of burying the past. There's three other, so he actually takes these idols and buries them under the tree at Shechem. And there's also three other burials that happen in this chapter. One is Deborah, Rebecca's nurse. And this is the closest connection we have to Rebecca's actual death, because we don't hear about that. But Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, is buried and he names it the Oak of Weeping. Rachel is buried near Bethlehem, and Benjamin's born through this process. We also have Isaac buried, but this section doesn't actually fit chronologically here, so just be aware. Isaac is still alive when, in chapter 37, you'll see Joseph go into slavery. Isaac is still alive, I believe, for 12 more years after that happens. So this is just one of those things to pull the history together. And so that's just a side note, that he is still alive at that point. So there's a couple other things that happen in this chapter of note. I'm assuming, are we close? Done? Okay. So in this chapter, we see God appear to Jacob again and bless him. And what does he do? He tells him again, your name is no longer Jacob. Your name is Israel. He had named him years before. It could have been 5 to 10 years before, but Jacob has been still living as Jacob. And he needs to move on and live as Israel. And live, Israel means strives with God, or God prevails. Kathy Rockman let me know that it also means God governs. Let God prevail. Let him govern your life and follow his ways, not your own ways. And these are his ways. This is what he's saying. He's saying, get rid of your past. I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall come from your own body. Now, then that's an interesting, he's telling him nations and kings will come. And the land that I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give your land, you give the land to your offspring after you. So he's telling him nations and kings are going to come, but that's going to be a little bit in the future, because actually slavery is coming next. And it's interesting to see when the nation of Israel gets sent into slavery, who does have kings and nations starting? Chapter 36 shows us Esau. Esau has been taking the method that these people of Shechem were wanting Jacob to take, the easy way to get your kingdoms and to get your nations. Let's see, Esau married a Hivite, a Hittite, an Ishmaelite, and maybe one other. And many of them were very prominent women. Their fathers were chiefs of those areas, and actually Esau takes over the area just to the south of the Dead Sea, where the Horites lived. So he basically takes over that area, and he may have married one of them too. He married a lot of women. A lot of women from a lot of nations, and he had a large people. But that's not the way God wanted his nation to be built. He wanted his nation to be separate from these people. So he's going to send them. In the next chapters, you're going to see God sending them out.